Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management, Mellon.com, and by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I'm sure this is just coincidence, but the next Federal Reserve interest rate announcement is scheduled for Halloween. And we got a pretty good idea today whether it's going to be trick or treat. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to the weekend, everybody. It's Friday, the 5th of October. And truth be told, the odds increased dramatically today that the Fed's not going to do a single darn thing in its next meeting. What might prove to be the deciding piece of information came from the Labor Department this morning. The economy added 110,000 new jobs last month, just about in line with expectations. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli drew the short straw out of our assignment meeting this morning, so he did what a lot of reporters did with today's job figures. He called around to some economists to find out exactly what the numbers mean. If you were perhaps hoping to gain a little clarity from that effort, maybe you didn't hear me. Those were economists he was talking to.
These folks must get together at some big economist convention months in advance and plan days like this as a practical joke. Some actual economist takes on today's jobs report? Here's our staff reading a few.
I think the developing trend is unfavorable.
Not necessarily a strong showing, but a steady one.
It looks like job creation's on a slow track.
As far as being in a recession already, never mind.
Then they all go home and pour themselves a nice drink. Michael Feroli at J.P. Morgan Chase is in the things are okay camp.
The economy is slowing, but it's not really collapsing.
Feroli says today's numbers fully take into account all the nasty credit crunch and subprime mortgage headlines.
These are numbers for September, and I think it's safe to say that if we were to see a sharp break in business behavior, it would probably be reflected to some degree in the September payroll report.
So, we're out of the woods? That's just one opinion. Here's another.
The trend rate of growth of private sector employment is clearly slowing and continues to pose risks for the broader economy.
That's Richard Moody at the Mission Residential Investing Firm in Texas. Moody sees a different sort of evidence in today's numbers.
There are a number of industries that are laying off workers. We had the smallest number of industries hiring last month that we had since January 2005.
If you can distill anything from The Economist, it's that there seems to be a lower risk of recession in today's numbers, but also less of a chance the economy will be taking off anytime soon. So no booms and no blowouts. The economists have spoken. Sort of. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
The other jobs figure that came out today was the unemployment rate. It nudged up 0.1% to 4.7%. The Labor Department says that's because there are more people out there looking for work than there were earlier. When next we talk about the unemployment picture, an announcement from General Electric will figure slightly in the calculations. GE is turning out the lights at 7 of its incandescent light bulb factories in the U.S., Brazil, and Mexico. Shuttering those plants will mean a loss of 1,400 jobs, mostly in Brazil. As Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, it's part of GE's campaign to get rid of slow-growing, low-margin businesses, even if the product in question was invented by the guy who founded the company.
This is the soft, pure light of the GE soft white bulb. It creates a soft, warm glow that's beautiful to see by.
General Electric may still bring good things to light, but fewer of them are bulbs. Lighting products now account for less than 2% of the company's yearly revenues. And GE says sales of traditional bulbs are dimming by at least 10% every year. GE's Deborah Wexler says consumers want more energy-efficient products.
We're seeing about a 45% annual growth rate since 2002 with CFLs.
That's compact fluorescents, those swirly-looking bulbs that use less energy and last 7 years. Kateri Callahan, president of the Alliance to Save Energy, says the global drive for energy efficiency is pushing the lighting market towards CFLs and so-called LEDs, now used in many traffic lights.
You have countries from Australia to the UK to the European Union, Canada, the United States, all looking at phasing out inefficient incandescent lighting over the next 3 to 10 years.
And at least a dozen states are considering similar legislation. Just this week, Walmart surpassed its goal of selling 100 million CFLs by the end of 2007. Some CFL users complain about the quality of CFL light, however. GE says it's trying to develop a bulb that's energy efficient, but still gives off that soft, warm glow its customers yearn for. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
This isn't to say the credit squeeze is over with, but there are some signs things might be starting to turn around. Deutsche Bank says the market for a certain type of security known as a CLO appears to be on the rebound. Bear with me here. Marketplace's Amy Scott is going to explain what CLOs are and why you ought to care about them.
CLO stands for Collateralized Loan Obligation. It's basically a pool of loans that trades like a stock or bond. Investors make money from the payments on the underlying loans. CLOs have financed a lot of the big corporate buyouts in recent years, but demand took a dive in July when investors started to shun any kind of questionable debt. According to Deutsche Bank, that demand is starting to pick up again. Last month, investors, including pension funds, bought close to $8 billion in CLOs. That's near pre-crunch levels. Martin Fridson runs the research service Leverage World. He says unlike securities backed by subprime mortgages, CLOs are backed by loans mostly in good standing.
It's not the case as it is in the mortgage-backed sector, where clearly there are already very substantial defaults.
Because CLOs are key to financing buyouts and mergers, a recovery in the CLO market might boost corporate deal-making, which had been a major driver of economic growth. But some observers say it's too soon to call a rebound. Mike Basevich invests in corporate loans for Hartford Investment Management. He says many of the CLOs issued in September had been in the works for months. He's not seeing any interest in new CLOs.
I was in New York just yesterday, and I met with four investment banking houses, and the response was universal, that while there might be a handful of issues that take place for the balance of this year, by and large, the CLO market is shut.
Basevich predicts it will be several months before it opens again, when enough brave souls step back into the market that others start to follow. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Investors were all hot and bothered by that unemployment report this morning. We'll have the details and the whole wide week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. There's a vote scheduled Sunday down in Costa Rica that drew comments from the Bush administration this week. Susan Schwab, the president's trade representative, said the White House is in no mood to renegotiate the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Schwab's comments were prompted by a massive public protest ahead of Sunday's referendum in Costa Rica. Voters there will have a chance to give the thumbs up or the thumbs down on the regional trade deal. We've got Marketplace's Dan Gretsch on the line from the Americas desk at WLRN in Miami. Hiya, Dan.
Hi, Kai.
Do you think people in favor of free trade should be worried and be paying special attention to what happens on Sunday?
I think that this is a kind of watershed referendum for several reasons. One, it's the first time that people are going to the polls to vote up or down on a free trade agreement. Generally, those are done by presidents and congresses, and this is taking it to the people. Costa Rica has also a really important symbolic value. It's Central America's most stable country. And if they basically turn their back on this trade deal, I think what's going to do for all of the other countries that are in the process of negotiating trade deals with the U.S. feel a little bit more squeamish about entering into a deal.
Obviously, if 100,000 people out of a country of plus or minus 4 million come out and protest as they did last weekend, they must have some pretty serious feelings behind it. What are the anti-CAFTA people in Costa Rica saying?
One of their biggest concerns, and this is something that's shared by their neighbors, is that CAFTA will put a lot of small farmers out of business. These markets are going to be flooded, they say, by cheap U.S. subsidized agricultural goods. And they simply can't compete in the face of that kind of competition. One of the things that Costa Ricans in particular are afraid of is they have free universal health care. And one of the ways they're able to pay for that is with cheap generic drugs. But the U.S. has forced some intellectual property provisions into CAFTA that would force Costa Rica to go with the more expensive name brand drugs produced by U.S. pharmaceuticals.
President Oscar Arias has said, I think the exact quote is that CAFTA failing in this referendum on Sunday would be a disaster for the country. How is he going to get it passed then?
One of the main tactics that the pro-trade folks are using is fear. And here's their argument. Free trade agreements offer investors and businesses who are looking to park their money somewhere a very stable financial regime, one that doesn't change with the political winds. So if an investor has an opportunity to put money in El Salvador, Nicaragua, or Guatemala, which all have passed this free trade agreement, Costa Rica is going to lose out on a lot of those new opportunities.
It has been in effect, CAFTA has, in some of those neighbors already. What do we know about what's happening on the ground?
Free trade in general has winners and losers, and some of the main losers are poor people, people who are farmers who have relied on a certain amount of protectionism to make their goods competitive within Costa Rica. In its first year, the big winner so far has been the U.S. Exports to the five CAFTA countries have grown by more than 16% in CAFTA's first year. Despite that, trade deals have kind of fallen out of favor in Congress. And if on Sunday, everyday Costa Ricans thumb their nose at the U.S., that could sour Congress on some upcoming deals with Colombia, Panama, and Peru.
Dan Gretsch at the Marketplace America's desk at WLRN in Miami. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Kai.
Munich, Germany is the center of the beer-drinking universe this week. Oktoberfest wraps up there on Sunday. The traditional fall festival of beer and other delicacies draws millions of visitors every year. If you're not, though, one of the faithful who's experienced authentic Oktoberfest for yourself, there are plenty of options here in the States. But beer's not only a party drink, you know, it's a commodity, too. Kate Golden discovered as much when a guest left the case of Bud Light behind at a party she threw.
I don't drink beer that comes in cans, but I figured other people do and might be willing to trade something to get it. So I turned to the online bulletin board Craigslist. I went to the barter section and typed in beer. The list bustled with potential trades, things like body jewelry or deer sausage. People will move furniture, tile bathrooms, and crochet for beer. Craigslist CEO Jim Buckmaster reads zillions of postings and says beer is a universal medium of exchange.
And also it adds a lighthearted note to the posting because there's this some notion of I like beer, you like beer, everyone likes beer, let's have some beer.
The Craigslist barter section is just the cyber version of a long-standing tradition. Beer historian Horst Dornbusch.
We surmise that beer became a human commodity right after mankind stepped out of the fog of prehistory.
Which was about 10,000 years ago in Iraq. And it stayed that way. 5,000-year-old hieroglyphics describe how the Sumerians rebelled over the state-controlled barter price for funeral services.
7 urns of beer. And the ruler of the day was King Urukagina. And he decided to appease his unruly populace by lowering the cost of a funeral to 3 urns only.
Dornbusch said beer has always been highly tradable.
It was universal. Everybody drank it. Also, as a liquid, it was easy to measure and to apportion. And finally, It also kept well because alcohol and certain beer flavorings served as preservatives.
In modern times, you'll be hard-pressed to find someone who's worked the beer trade more fully than Rick Mahos. Just starting out as a young bike mechanic, he made most of his living in beer.
This thing started happening, like, one of my friends, I fixed their bike and they bought me a beer, and then people started finding out that, you know, I would do mechanic work for trade.
Mahos laid out some rules for me.
So what kind of beer do you like?
Alcoholic beer.
Would you be insulted if someone gave you cheap beer for the work that you had done?
I guess if I did an extensive job, I wouldn't want, like, a Pabst or something.
Mahos says there were times clients never delivered. This is an informal system. But now that he works at an established Bay Area bike shop, his boss pays him in cash.
Which then I translate into beer.
Mahos says getting actual dollars is kind of a drag because he's just going to convert them into beer anyway.
I don't think my landlord would want me to pay my rent in Pabst.
I, on the other hand, had no problem finding another mechanic to fix my broken bike for that case of Bud Light. In Oakland, California, this is Kate Golden for Marketplace.
Well, 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 David Johnson, where does one begin this week?
Well, how about a few impressions?
All right, go ahead.
My impression of the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Yes.
Never mind.
That's right. Explain that for us, would you?
So a month ago, some of us just around halfway around the world were quaking at our boots because the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Labor Department, told us there were 4,000 job losses.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't seen job losses in years. And you know what happened? And it just fed the fire that we were all worried about subprime anyway and the credit crunch. And here came Ben Bernanke riding to our rescue by cutting. And then so they come out today and they say, well, we forgot about some government jobs, and so we didn't have job losses. We didn't have very many job gains, but we had 89,000 job gains.
Right. And then, of course, this morning, that 110,000 figure, and it's off to the races in your line of work.
Yeah. But, so, you know, seriously, this is an interesting week because we're going to look back on this week and the last maybe 10 days as an important period because this subprime business is not over with. And the credit crunch certainly has eased a lot. But there's still going to be, you know, more surprises in quarterly earnings. There are going to be companies that go under, and there are going to be still more job losses in these industries. But what we found out, I think this week, more than any other time, is we found out the depth of this problem. And what it's looking like more and more is it's fairly contained. And if we're talking to anybody in the housing business or any mortgage bankers, I'm sorry, I know it's the end of the world, but to everybody else, it's not that bad.
Well, define your terms here. I mean, who exactly are we talking about?
Everybody else. We're seeing, you know, I've talked to several officials this week who said, you know, we're seeing close to full employment, if not full employment. And it was also the week that we saw corporate America do exactly what we should do if you have, say, for example, a bad piece of fish.
Yeah.
You don't take a Rolaid, right? You purge it. You get it out. Bring it up. And that's what UBS did, and that's what Deutsche Bank did, and Merrill did it to the tune of $5 billion this morning.
So they're just you're talking about this write-off that Merrill had in all these big banks, where especially on Monday they just said, you know what, we're gonna cleanse our books and move swiftly forward.
Yeah, and the sense is that they cleansed the books of not only everything that was apparent, but maybe did a little hedging just in case. And so that's it. So now we look back on the week and we say, okay, we see the breadth of the problem and ideally the depth of the problem, and it's something we can handle. And so we're going to go out and buy stocks with reckless abandon.
I'm going to paraphrase Winston Churchill here as we work our way to the end of this conversation. What we have here really is sort of the end of the beginning of the subprime crunch, right?
I think in the case of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it's more like Cool Hand Luke. What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yeah, that's right. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Man, you always one-up me on those things. I hate that.
Have a great weekend,
Kyle.
You
too. We'll see you next time. Coming up, work without email? How hard can that be?
Delete, delete, delete.
Sir, you can't delete something you've said out loud.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 91 points today, 2/3 of 1%, to tidy up the week at 14,066. The NASDAQ rode up 46 points. That's 1.7% there, ended at 2780. The S&P 500 ticked up 14 points, nearly 1%, to finish at 1557. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow climbed 1.2%. The S&P 500 advanced 2%. The NASDAQ rose 2.9%. Research in Motion dialed up 13% today following yesterday's gleaming profit report. Seems BlackBerries are selling, well, they're selling like BlackBerry hotcakes. Google gained 2.5% after Bear Stearns raised its price target on that stock. Merrill Lynch shined up 2.5% after that write-down that Johnson talked about. Washington Mutual is setting aside nearly $1 billion in the third quarter to cover its own potential future losses. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Siemens, from strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com. Marketplace is podcasting. Marketplace Takeout is a mix of our best stories from the past week, the cream of the crop from our reporters around the world, delivered to you on the go wherever you are. Want to sign up? Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link at the top of the page. Or you can download entire shows of Marketplace and Marketplace Money at audible.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. It's Columbus Day, a holiday for some, but the markets will be open for business as usual. The Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine is announced in Stockholm. And on October 8, 1957, it was announced that the Brooklyn Dodgers would relocate across the country to Los Angeles. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Have a great weekend.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. One small slice of the party that is Las Vegas, Nevada will take on a slightly different tone this weekend. The National Funeral Directors Association will be having its annual convention. This year's event features an Asia Expo where those in the business can learn all about funeral rituals of the Far East. You can also check out a workshop called Risk Reduction for Funeral Cremation Providers. Commentator Doug Cordell won't be there, but he's become a funeral planner just the same.
Recently, my mother and I began planning her funeral, or at least we've been trying. She's healthy, but just turned 90, so it's not like we're being hasty. And it was her idea. Sitting me down in the TV room of her condo, she announced that she wanted to make her wishes known now so there'd be no confusion, and no unscrupulous funeral director would take advantage. Aside from the obvious mortality question, what make conversations like these awkward are the financial considerations. My mother's a child with a depression, so money enters into everything. Me, I tell her, blow the bank, get a marching band. But that's not her style. She thinks even an ordinary funeral, with the flowers and the casket and the limousine, is a waste of money. Money she'd rather pass on to her kids. It's a racket, she says. Lately, she's been thinking about cremation. All her friends are doing it. She points out that none of us ever visits my father's grave anyway, because it's far away in a run-down neighborhood, and because he's not there, really. That gets us sidetracked into a talk about my dad, how little thought he would have given to all this business, and how much we both still miss him after all these years. We discuss scattering her ashes. She says there are charter outfits that will take your remains out to sea, but they probably charge a fortune. And what's the point of scattering her ashes at sea, she wonders. She's never even liked boats. But if we toss them on land, should it be in Florida, where she lives now, or in New York, where she grew up? That leads us to her childhood in Brooklyn, and memories of watching her mother cook on Sunday afternoons. And as she shares them with me, I can easily see the little girl she once was. The conversations meander, and we never arrive at any conclusions about funeral arrangements. But that doesn't seem to be the point. It's more about the meandering. From time to time, my mother raises the topic again. We talk about various scenarios and about not throwing money away. And then we talk about other things.
Writer Doug Cordell lives in New York City. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. Should you happen to know somebody who works at Intel, don't take offense if they didn't answer your email today. This was the first of the company's new Zero Email Fridays. Workers are discouraged from sending digital correspondence. Instead, they're supposed to take some time and actually talk to each other, as in face-to-face. Other companies have similar policies. We don't, but the marketplace players thought it might take some workers a while to adapt.
Hello, everyone.
Hi there.
Hello.
And thanks for coming to the Globeco Sales Department's first No Email Friday meeting. Who are you?
I'm Amanda Luttrell. I've been your secretary for 5 years.
Oh, you're secretary girl at Globeco.org.
That's me.
That is you. Love your SIG files. And you?
Jackson McGillicuddy.
That's Chinese to me, Jackson. Let's stick with screen names.
Hardbody at Globeco.org. You hired me yesterday.
Don't have much of a hard body, though, do you, hard body?
I guess not. I'm kind of skinny.
Well, let's open up the discussion to secretary girl at Globeco.org, semicolon, hardbody at Globeco.org, subject increasing sales figures.
Excuse me, sir?
Yes. Yes?
You don't have to phrase everything in the form of an email.
No?
No.
Nope.
Oh, well then, I'll just say something.
Sir, you're picking your nose?
You can see that?
Yes, sir.
I do that all the time in front of the computer.
You do?
No.
You just said you did.
Delete, delete, delete.
Sir, you can't delete something you've said out loud.
Oh.
Are you looking at pornography?
Well, yeah, I do it all the time online. Hey, have you guys seen that YouTube video of the kitten eating corn on the cob?
Yeah, that's so sweet.
I like the one where the guy skateboards into a barbed wire fence.
Ouch. Okay, I think I've taken up enough of your time. Meeting adjourned. That was fun, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's never do it again.
Rico Galliano is our resident scribe. He gets a performance credit, too, along with Michelle Philippi and Brendan Nuno.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, trendy as energy bars are, in point of fact, Native Americans have been on to the secret for ages. Last December, Steve Tripoli brought us the story of a company in South Dakota hoping to repackage and market a more traditional high-protein snack. The Tonka bar is a combination of dried buffalo meat and cranberries. Tonka translates roughly to big idea, a fitting name, says company president Mark Tilson.
Coming from the Pioneers Reservation, which is one of the poorest places in the country, and this is as grand and as big as you could think of to launch a national and hopefully someday an international brand.
We talked to Mark at the Black Hills Powwow out in South Dakota, where he's launching that bar today. He says his company, Native American Natural Foods, has produced 100,000 bars for the launch, and they've almost sold out.
Every time somebody tastes it, their eyebrows go up and they say, that's not what I expected, because, you know, it's all natural and the cranberries are almost whole in there. And so when you bite into them, you get this burst that we call the taste of energy.
As opposed to the sawdust that most energy bars taste like. But good flavor is not cheap. A Tonka bar will set you back $2.25. And that is Marketplace on a Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 91 points, two-thirds of 1% after that unemployment report. The NASDAQ jumped 46 points. That's 1.7%. The S&P 500 added 14 points, nearly 1% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Yor. Coming up on Monday, Londoners look for new ways to save money after a banking bust.
I'm very tempted to do what my mother-in-law used to do and stick it under the mattress.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.